I think, as many of you know, if you didn't know it before, you know it now when you see me teach. Whenever I do meditation or teach meditation, I always put a lot of fun and games into the meditation to make it a happy meditation, because that is very important. Some meditation retreats are so serious and so frightening that I know that the president was keeping on mentioning the word entertainment at Monash University. Where she got that story from was, I was going to teach a meditation retreat in Sydney at Wat Buddha Dhamma, and the man who was driving me to that center in his car was telling me about the previous retreats where he had to sit for hour after hour after hour enduring pain. And he said he called that meditation hall the torture chamber. And when I heard that, I thought, oh, come on, meditation shouldn't be torture. And so when I went on to that retreat, I rechristened the meditation hall, not the torture chamber, but the entertainment center, just to give a different idea of what meditation is and what it does. It really, if it's working, it creates not just peace and insight, but happiness, joy, energy. You feel bubbly, you're happy. And to emphasize that point, I quoted one of my favorite suttas from the Majjhima Nikaya, the Dhammacaddiya Sutta, usually translated as monuments to the Dhamma, Dhammacaddiya Sutta. And in that particular teaching, there is the King Pasenadi of Kosala, who lived in Sarvati, just a short walking distance from the famous Jetavana or Jetagrove Monastery, where the Buddha spent, I think, 25 rains retreats. Oh my goodness, this is more. We're going to be here very late tonight. And anyway, I don't mind answering questions. Anyway, King Pasenadi of Kosala, just before he passed away, he went to see the Buddha. And when he went into the Buddha's hut, the first thing he did was grab the Buddha's feet and start kissing them. And the Buddha said, what are you doing that for, King? And the King said, look, you know, you've been my teacher for so many years, and I love you. And I love coming to this monastery. You know, he really was emotionally attached to the Buddha, as obviously you can imagine people would become, this beautiful, soft, wise, compassionate, amazing being. But the Buddha said, why do you like coming to the monastery, to the Jetagrove? And this is the important part of the story. He said, because whenever I go into this particular monastery, the monks are always smiling and happy. And the Buddha replied, yes, great King, that's what you can expect when the monks are having success in their meditation and when they're developing insight. Now that's an important statement. You can tell if the monks or the nuns are getting good meditation by how happy they are. That's right, smile a bit more. And that's true, they're smarty enough, nuns. But if you ever come across a miserable monk who's always serious and never smiles once, sometimes you ask, what's happening? Are they really meditating? Are they getting any joy? Because the Buddha said, what you can expect, if people meditate and get success in meditation, and they get success in insight, you get happiness, visible. And that's the same with you. So if you have a happy time here, then you know your meditation has gone well. And if you're even more miserable than when you came in here, then you're wasting your time. You're not getting it. So the happiness is part and parcel of the meditation. As you let go of suffering, as you get closer to Nirvana, the more suffering you let go of, the less attachments you have, the lighter you feel, the more peaceful, the more happy, the more smiley you are. Now that's a sign your meditation is going well. So when you come and say, oh, I get these lights or I get these insights, I can sit for 2 hours, as I mentioned earlier, that doesn't mean so much to me. But if you're happy and you're smiling, say, yep, you're getting some progress in your meditation and in your insight. And then also it means that people will ask you, why are you so happy for? You say, because I meditate. And then more and more people will want to meditate. As I mentioned in Singapore many years ago, this, the smile, is the greatest marketing tool for Buddhism and for meditation. If people come along and they see happy people after a meditation retreat, they know, yes, we want to do that also. Unfortunately, in many meditation retreats, people aren't so happy, which is why they usually take the group photograph at the end of a retreat. Because that's usually when people are happy. You know why? Not because they got deep meditation, because they're going home. So I insist on taking group photographs in the middle of the retreat, so you see what people really are like. Because at the end of my meditation retreats, when you take the group photographs, people are crying and they're sad. I don't want to go home. I want to meditate more. I'm exaggerating there, but you get the point. So happiness is part of meditation. And if happiness comes, develop it, encourage it. It's what's supposed to happen. So don't be too serious when you're meditating. Number one, can we use meditation to cure diseases such as cancer? If so, how? Yeah, what's the cause of cancer? The stress, that's what it is. Do you know the story of the guy who went to the psychiatrist? Went in the psychiatrist's office and said, sometimes I think I'm a marquee. Sometimes I think I'm a teepee. You know a teepee, the wigwams, which the Indians used to use. Psychiatrist said, pardon? Sometimes you think you're a marquee. Sometimes you think you're a teepee. I never heard that before. And then he had an insight. Ah, I know your problem. You're too tense. It's a very bad joke, isn't it? Anyway, that's one of the causes of cancers. People just are so tense and so uptight. And no wonder you get all these diseases in the body. So the first thing is just to relax and learn how to meditate to get peace in the mind, relaxation in the body, happiness in the heart, and you're doing your very, 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 very best you possibly can to actually lessen the cancers, at least to stabilize the tumors. And just to maybe even allow those tumors to shrink, which they do. You do a little bit of chemotherapy and radiation therapy. Don't just ignore sort of the advances of modern science, but do meditation as well. It's a very potent combination. And if you do your meditation, not with fear, because that just makes you more tense, this beautiful, peaceful openness, you find that very likely you live a long, long time. And I just, there's so many stories of people curing their cancers from meditation. And I was just saying during the tea break, one of these guys, Keith, 25 years. He should have been dead 25 years ago when I first came to Perth. He said he came to the temple because he was dying of cancer. And now he's in an old people's home. He's still alive. Nothing can kill him. He's still got the cancer there, it's just there, it's just part of him. It hasn't gone, hasn't killed him, nothing's happened. He's a great meditator. So when you can lessen your stress, then a lot of times you're doing the very, very best. And if the cancer does cure you anyway, then you go into death laughing, because you're just so peaceful and happy. Why not? You're going to die anyway. So it's not when you die, it's how you die. And when you know how to sort of relax and be peaceful, then when you're alive, when you're dying, no problems at all. You can die with class, which is a wonderful way to die. Any questions about that? So actually meditators usually just have a wonderful time with cancer. many of them just survive it without much problem. And if you do die, you die really well. You win both ways. So that's why meditation is just so popular for people with cancer. That's why my retreat center, I made it very comfortable for sick people. Everyone's got their own ensuite, especially to encourage people with cancer, even in the advanced stages of cancer, so they can come and meditate. Because I know as a fact just how beneficial that's going to be for them. Either just putting their cancers into recession, not recession, that's economy, remission, that was the right word. Or just actually just dying well. Any comments about that? Okay. During the last sitting, the mind is just bright. At times they are like the light when dawn is breaking. At times the color purple. Pure expand, but no brilliant light yet. Sometimes the light seems brighter at a certain corner of the mind. Please explain, Ajahn. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, that sometimes, especially when I make a lot of talk about nimittas and light, people like to see the light so much, that even small lights they start to see. But remember, it's the best time for these lights to come up is when you're very still and calm. So don't rush. Do the preparatory work. Be as still as you possibly can, first of all. And the more still you are, the more calm and peaceful you are. But when the light comes up, it's very nice and very beautiful. So it's actually brilliant. That's the best one. And you know what the reason why it's brilliant? Because your mind is brilliant. You've got so much stillness, the energy is poured in to your mind, and that's why it's brilliant. So if you're watching a nimitta and it's not bright yet, it means there's not enough energy there, because you've been doing things, you just need to be still. And wait a bit longer, and it brightens up. Sometimes you say it's brighter in one corner. Sometimes nimittas come up and they're not centered. They're sort of to the left or the right, up or down somewhere. And that sometimes is a problem for people. But you don't need to do anything. Just do nothing. It centers itself at the right time. And if you've got some part of it which is more brilliant than the other, you just give yourself the suggestion, go for the more brilliant part. And just the mind just goes and centers on that. And that sort of takes off into a beautiful nimitta. After a while, your mind knows what to do. You don't even need to tell it. It's just like the dog. You sort of go to the cupboard and get out the leash, and the dog has got its head in the leash straight away because it just wants to go out for walkies. This is that mind is like that sometimes. As soon as it sees an nimitta, great! And off it goes. So when you know what you're doing, the mind likes these meditations so much, you know, you can't even hold it back, you just off it goes. Any questions about that or comments about that? Okay, the next question coming up. My friend and his wife in late 50s say, we don't do wrong things. We don't do any harm to others. We make our money in a very reasonable way. Why worry about religion, karma, rebirth, etc.? Ha ha ha. These people are going to get a shock. They're what we call in psychology in denial. We don't do wrong things. Yeah, I'm sure they do some wrong things. They think that drinking alcohol is not wrong. I bet they have sort of a few whiskies or something. I bet just like everybody else, they don't declare all their taxable income. I'm sure that, you know, when the police aren't around, they sort of go over the speed limit. Because they're human beings and they're ordinary. But not only that, yeah, you don't do wrong things, you don't do any harm to others, you make our money in a very reasonable way. That's a very similar to what Wisakha's husband used to say. Wisakha, I mentioned her this morning, this was the chief female lay disciple of the Buddha. She got married to a non-Buddhist. And so she wanted to give alms food to the Buddha and the monks, and her husband prohibited her, said no. You know, he said, we don't do wrong things, we don't do any harm to others, we make our money a very reasonable way. Why worry about these stupid monks? They should go and earn their own money. He didn't actually say that, but that's the sort of thing he would have said. And so Visakha, she was an incredibly wise woman. She said to all of her friends, "Ah, oh, my husband, he only gets us old food to eat." And she went around saying, "We only eat old food in this house." And when the husband heard that, he was really upset. And he scolded her, "What do you mean we only eat old food? I send our servants to the market every day. Everything we eat is fresh." Now this is a wise thing, because then she hits him with the meaning. She said, "We only eat old karma. The reason why we have our health and our money and our well-being is because the karma you made in your previous lives. But as for this life, you're not making any good karma whatsoever. Yeah, you have health, you have wealth, you have prosperity. But that's because you're using the old food, the old karma." So I tell those people, you're living in a good country, you've got reasonable health, you have the ability to earn good money, you're not in a war-torn country, you're not being bombed. That's because you've made good karma in the past. And now, whoever this family is, tell them they're eating old food. Soon it will run out. And when it runs out, when they do get their cancers, or they do get their dementia, or they do get other problems of old age, then they will understand why we teach these laws of karma. Why you have a human life, which is very precious, to make sure you make merit, you make good karma, make sure that you actually learn about the nature of your body and mind, that you train your body and mind, so that by the end, when you get old and when it's a bit too late to do things, you realize, yes, I have spent my life well. It's not just not doing wrong things, it's doing good things. It's not just doing no harm to others, it's being kind to others. It's not just making your money in a very reasonable way, it's using it in a reasonable way. These are all negatives. I don't do this, I don't do that, I don't do something else. But what are you doing? Because even, well, it looks like a dog doesn't do any wrong things, doesn't do any harm to others, it makes its food in a reasonable way. So they're no better than a dog. Don't tell them I said that, otherwise I'll get in big trouble. So it's not just what you don't do, it's what you do do. You've got the opportunity, Jesse, to make some really good karma. So it's not just about not doing wrong things, it's about doing good things. It's not about not doing any harm to others, it's doing kind, compassionate, generous acts to others. It's not just making your money in a very reasonable way. That's good, but that's not enough. Having made your money in a reasonable way, use your money in a reasonable way. You know what many people have said? I think I mentioned this earlier. There was some sort of psychologist found out that you get much more happiness giving to someone else than spending the money on yourself. You always do that. You know, if you've got your old mother and you buy her a gift, or, you know, you give your dog an extra sort of bone, then you get much more happiness from that than if you sort of spent the money on yourself. That's why people love going shopping for somebody else. It's quite nice when you do that. You can turn them on, make them happy, and you give them the gift, and wow, isn't that nice? That's why, you know, I'll tell you my story of the socks. I never wear socks, because, you know, this was inside, you find out, stamped on me is made in England. Because I was born in England, I've got very good circulation, I'm used to cold, so I don't really need socks. Even when I was a kid, I would, you know, go in the snow without any socks on, just in flip-flops, because I really got good circulation. So one day, over in Perth, there's two sock stories, this is sock story number one. Over in Perth, this old Sri Lankan lady knitted me a pair of socks. And just before the talk, she gave me this pair of socks. She said, "I've knitted this specially for you." And what did I say? Did I say, "No, I don't need socks. I don't wear socks. I don't do things like that." I said, "Oh, thank you so much." And I put them on. And as I was giving the talk, actually I was sitting like this. Let's do it. Those in the front row can see what happened. I was sitting like this, and as I usually do, cross-legged, you can't see my feet. And as I was giving the talk, she was sitting over there, I was just moving my robe, and I was giving the talk, and I pushed out my foot on purpose. And as I was looking over here giving the talk, I was half looking over there, and she blurted out to her friend, "He's wearing my socks! He's wearing my socks!" And I enjoyed that, she enjoyed that, and now you enjoy that. What a wonderful thing that was. And that's how you deal with gifts, and what a wonderful, joyful thing that is. And the second time was a few years ago here in Melbourne. I forget who it was, but she had cancer. I think she was just had an operation. She was in one of the hospitals over here. So they asked, you know, can you go and visit her? I think it was on the way back to the airport to go home. And so, you know, went in there to visit her. You took me there, you know that story. And so she gave me a pair of socks. So again, I put them on to make her feel happy. And as we went outside to get to your car, we had to walk underneath her window. And as we walked underneath her window, I hitched up my robe. And it was like dancing so she could make sure she could see my socks. And I looked up, there she was at the window with this big smile on her face. That's how you deal with generosity. You know, you celebrate it. Even though I took off the socks when I got back and gave it to somebody else, but at least you made people feel happy. Now that's how sort of we deal with generosity, and that's what makes it happy. So when it's not just not doing anything, I'm not doing anything wrong. Go out of your way to make happiness in this world by being kind, by being generous, by being caring, by being forgiving. It's not what you don't do sends you to heaven, makes happiness. It's what you do do. So the Buddha said, don't do anything unskillful. Do what is skillful and purify the mind. Those are the teachings of the Buddha. Yeah, they're doing one of the three, but there's another two to be done. Ajahn Brahm, when I am aware of my breath, sometimes my fingers are suddenly moving with a little shock. It is happening time to time during meditation process. Is this usual? Please advise. How old are you? Parkinson's. Parkinson's disease. Writing on the other side. Oh, it's. That's why that when I was trying to do something about bhikkhuni ordination, you know, some of the senior monks in Thailand, just the ones which are stopping it all. So I decided to write to the movers and shakers, because they're so old, that's who they are. All got Parkinson's disease. But anyway, I'm going to get in trouble for this. But no, if your fingers suddenly move during meditation, this is seriously now, this is just, there's some tension in there. Which is, you know, sometimes this tension is locked in all sorts of places in the body. And when you're meditating, you're letting go of control, you're putting your mind somewhere else, and this is a time when that tension can be released. So this is actually quite normal. It's actually usually a good sign, shows you relaxing a lot and allowing inner tension to come out. But sometimes that does happen for some people that are meditating. Sometimes they do get a shock. There's something twitches. Or sometimes people actually arm comes up. They said it's quite a rare thing. They didn't know why it happened. They said they didn't do that. And all it is some sort of tightness and tension. It could be some physical accident. They happened a long time ago. It can be emotional tension. But something gets locked in the body. And when you get very calm and still, the body has an opportunity, when you're not controlling things, to actually intervene and to release that tension. So if that happens, I'll just let it happen. No problem at all. It's actually quite positive and good. I mean, something there is being released. So well done. Any comments about that? Okay, next question. Is perfect stillness be experienced only by a noble person? No, perfect stillness is also experienced by a dead person. You're going to see that one coming. sometimes you don't know the difference. So that's why this one of the great stories in the sort of the commentaries. There was this monk, and he got into such a deep meditation. He was in the jungle, in the forest. He was sitting absolutely still. And these two foresters, they were going into the forest and jungle to look for some herbs or some roots or something. They were Buddhists. And they saw this monk. They recognized him. He was sitting there so still. They looked at him. They checked him up. Couldn't see any breathing. They said, "Oh my goodness, the Venerable One has died." And because they were devout Buddhists, they say, "Look, we can't just go past this Venerable Monk, because the jungle animals will just go and chew him and eat him. And that's not a respectable way to deal with your monks." So even though it's going to take them time and they're going to be late going to collect whatever they were supposed to be collecting, they got some wood together and built a funeral pyre. It doesn't take that long. And they lifted the monk's body and put it on top and set it alight. When the flames were sort of established, now they were busy, they knew that it would burn out and he would be cremated, so they went off to do their job. And so they collected their stuff and went back to the village. And you can imagine their surprise the following morning when the monk came for arms round. Not even his robe was burnt or charred. And that's the story of what happens to you in deep meditation. Even if someone puts you on top of a fire, it doesn't burn. Don't ask me why, but it doesn't happen. There was one monk I did know. This is a modern story. He was an Indonesian monk. He had amazing meditation and powers. And he told me that, before he became a monk, he was interested in Buddhism and meditation. And so he went into the jungles of Indonesia, in Java. And he sat down and he got into such a deep state of meditation. It's actually interesting what he said. He saw this star and he just came and he just merged into this star, the Nimitta. And he didn't know how long he was sitting there. But when he came out, he noticed there'd been a flood. He could see the marks on the trees. It was a couple of meters, a meter or so above him. He'd actually been submerged. And he asked the villagers afterwards and said, "Yeah, where you were, it was all flooded." He'd been underwater for days. Nothing had actually harmed him because he was in deep meditation. That's a modern story. I remember one of my disciples, he was teaching in Thailand for a little while. And one of my disciples there, she said that she was really meditating with him, just like, you were sitting in front of me, and she felt something really weird. She opened her eyes and said, from this monk's eyes, she saw two like laser lights going straight towards her. It was like out of the movies, out of Spider-Man or something. Not that I've seen Spider-Man, but does he have X-ray eyes? No, Superman has X-ray eyes, I remember. Is that right? Like Superman, X-ray eyes, just the lights. And she was just a well-educated girl. She said it was the most amazing thing she'd seen. I wasn't imagining it. This guy really had his powers. So, and he was submerged for days. Perfectly okay. So it does not matter if you get into a deep meditation and they send you to the crematorium, they take you out of the fire and you'll still be there. Not that it would happen. So is perfect stillness experienced only by a noble person, or by a dead person as well? Is stillness and emptiness the same thing? It's the only way you can become still is when you're empty. There's something left there, there's something to move. So you empty yourself of all of your attachments. Empty yourself of all time so there's no past and future. Empty yourself of all thought. Empty yourself of all perception of the body so you don't even feel the breath. Empty yourself of all will and choosing and doing until there's absolute stillness. When there's nothing left, that's when you're still. When something is there, there'll always be movement. This is why, as you disappear, more and more you get closer to emptiness. Now, this is a great place to tell my Ajahn Chah story. Because, this is in the book, when Ajahn Chah, just before he had his stroke and was not able to speak, he knew he was getting sick, and he told us that he was getting sick. And so the Western monks, we talked together, we had this brilliant idea to build a sauna. Because saunas were described in the ancient texts. They were used in monasteries in India. Saunas did not begin in Sweden. Buddhist monks had them 2,500 years ago in India. So this was traditional. We built a sauna in our monastery so we could invite our teacher over once a week to have a sauna for his health, but actually it was just to get him around so he'd give us a Dhamma talk. And it worked brilliantly. He would come once a week, give a Dhamma talk, and then he would go off to the sauna and we'd help him in his sauna. So it was a brilliant sort of idea and it worked. So we got our teacher once a week to give us a talk. But on this one occasion, he gave this talk. And it was a brilliant talk. Sometimes it just really hit the nail on the head. And I was so inspired afterwards. There was lots of other monks to look after the teacher. So they went to help him, you know, with his bathing cloth, with his towel in the sauna, give him a massage. And I went behind the hall to meditate. When you're inspired, you've got lots of joy. It's so easy to meditate. So there I was in the back of the hall, just really getting into a deep meditation. I'd never realized how long I was in that meditation for. But when I came out afterwards, I was just so peaceful and so happy and so clear. I thought, let's go and see if my teacher's still there. Maybe I can still do a service for him. So I went walking towards the sauna, but I was too late because I met Ajahn Chah, who's coming in the opposite direction with two Thai people, going to the car to go back to his monastery. But remember, I'd just come out of a deep meditation. And this was one of the great meditation masters of our time, Ajahn Chah. And as he came close towards me, he knew, he saw I was just come out of deep meditation. He had a look which you knew he was looking right inside of you, reading your mind. And he saw I was very clear. So he tried to enlighten me. He looked at me and he held me with his eyes. Rama Wangso! Why? That's how he did it. He was asking me the deepest question. Why? And I replied, I don't know. I was only a young, stupid monk. And the nature of these great monks, he just laughed. He cracked up laughing because we stupid Western monks gave him so much happiness. But then he screwed up his face again and he looked at me, wasn't laughing anymore, and he said, Brahma Wangsa, I'll tell you the answer. And I was really interested, because this was coming from a really wise, great monk. The answer to the question, why? He said, if anyone ever asks you that question again, the answer to the question, why, is, my me arai. That's Thai. Which means, you ready yet for the camera? This is historic. The answer to the question, why, is, there is nothing. There is nothing. And then he said, do you understand? And I said, yes. And he said, no, you don't. And then he walked away. Very deflating, but you know, he's a great teacher. But that's a sort of encounter. You remember. And you think about that. What did he mean? The answer to the question why is emptiness. There's nothing there. You understand? No, you don't. But anyway, that's emptiness. Stillness shows you emptiness. When you're still, you can understand what emptiness is. When I meditate after some time, I do tend to focus on this dull light. I try to focus on that breath, but I see that something awareness regarding light is stronger. This light is a brighter version of the light that I experience and apparently others experience. When they close their eyes, what is it? How do I focus more on the breath? Or can I just be aware of that light? Thanks. Now, what you're doing here, it does not matter what you're aware of, a dull light of breath, whatever. What are you doing with that awareness? How are you aware of these things? And too often, many of you, when you see a light, you're aware of that with attachment, with desire. Hey, I've got a light. I've got to tell someone about this. So it's how you are aware just be peaceful, just be gentle, just let go. Stop controlling, judging, measuring. Just make peace, whatever happens. This is actually how you meditate. So if you want to go deeper, it doesn't matter you've got a beautiful light or a dull light. That's not important. What's important is how you're reacting to that. What are you doing with it? If you're doing anything, you're missing the path. Your job is just to be peaceful, to let go. Allow things to be. Open the door of your heart to whatever's happened. Create more causes for deeper stillness. And that's all you can do. There's a great poem in the Visuddhimagga. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Great lines. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Which means that when there's a traveller there, you doing your meditation, then there's no path to enlightenment at all. The more you disappear by doing less, the more the path is apparent. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. So your job is to disappear, just to be still, not do anything. And then the path of meditation to enlightenment is very clear, like a big highway. The more you are there, the more it's like a tightrope which you keep falling off. Stop doing things and controlling things and judging and making it happen. All you're making is just trouble for yourself. Let go. Be content. Open the door of your heart to whatever you're experiencing, no matter how beautiful or crazy it is. Be still. And that's how you become still, by doing nothing. Any questions about that one? Okay, next one. In the morning, you told that husbands and wives should respect each other's views and not to be critical. Always these leads to arguments. How do you use meditation in daily life with these kinds of situations to avoid these? Easy, shut up. Marriage would be much easier with duct tape. A lot of times, how often you married people have put your foot in the mouth because you've had it open. You keep your mouth closed. And as I said this morning, if you can't improve upon the silence, shut up, be quiet. If you are going to say something kind. And for those people who want to know about husbands and wives, there was an article which I read just about 6 or 9 months ago, which I'm kicking myself for not keeping because it was a brilliant article on psychology. This lady was doing a PhD in psychology, and for her thesis she went to one of these marine parks where they train dolphins to jump through hoops. She wanted to find out, how do you use psychology to make these wild animals do all these tricks? And what she found was basic positive reinforcement. Incremental rewards, I think was the name of the process. When that dolphin, just from the wild, jumped maybe an inch above the water, they would throw them a fish. They'd give them a reward. But when the dolphin did nothing, they would not punish, they would just ignore. But when the dolphin jumped 2 inches out of the water, then they'll get another fish. 3 inches, another fish. It was incremental rewards. Every time you did that other little level where the trainers wanted you to go, you got another fish. Until eventually that dolphin would jump through the hoops. Now this lady had a great insight. She changed her thesis into not how you train dolphins, but how you train husbands. And she realized that the same things which work with training dolphins actually work with husbands. And her thesis she wrote, and it was an abridged version, and it was so funny and so accurate, which shows how you can train a husband. In other words, incremental rewards. when he does something you like, you throw him a fish, metaphorically speaking, that is. When he doesn't do the task you want, you completely ignore it. The trouble is, in real life, you just criticize each other when you don't do the right thing, which is why it never works. We just get frustrated. So when he does something wrong, or she does something you don't like, shut up. But when they do something you do like, or you do want, the behavior you want to see happen in your family, give a reward. And she had her own experience. She never told her husband what she was up to, but she had her task she wanted her husband to do, and she wrote in this wonderful thesis, but I'm sure she got PhD with honors because she deserved it, on how to train a husband. And it was brilliant, and how effective it was. Just with incremental rewards. But when you argue, that doesn't work. So that's why I say, just stop this argument business with your family. So how do you use meditation in daily life for these kinds of situations? Meditation gives you insight. And the insight, you know how the mind works, how people work. And it's easy how you can just train husbands, how you can train your wife. So Buddhist families are happy ones because you train each other to be nice people. Ajahn Brahm, during the last meditation session, I started thinking about my son instead of meditation. When I realized this, I stopped thinking. Is this controlling? Thank you. No, the effort to stop is good. So when it's controlling, it's actually, what I mean is making things happen. But the effort to say no, to stop, that's a right effort which you should do in meditation. So if the mind is going in a stupid place, just say stop. But don't make a big thing out of it. Just stop, that's all. Just like Angulimala. When he was chasing the Buddha and saying, stop monk, stop monk. And the Buddha turned around, I've stopped. What do you mean you've stopped? You're still running, Buddha. He said, I have stopped. Not just stop killing people, but many other things I've stopped as well. You stop. And that's a powerful saying. Stop. When I started teaching meditation here yesterday, I made the point that most people are always journeying, going on to the next thing. In life, you're just going on to the next job, the next task, the next degree. Some of you go on to the next boyfriend, the next girlfriend, the next husband, the next child. You go on to the next job, then you go on to your retirement, then you go on to the next heaven, whatever. You're always going on to the next thing, always doing something. Meditation is stopping. You're not going anywhere. Staying where you already are. Stopping. Those of you who are meditating, trying to go on to the nimitta, trying to go on to jhana, again, you're missing the point. You stop where you are. Right here. You don't move at all. And then the jhanas come to you. Or like that simile I gave of the donkey and the carrot. When donkey stops, the carrot comes to donkey. So don't move. Don't keep on going on to the next thing. But stopping, yes, that's a path to enlightenment. Any questions about that? Oh, very good. How important is closing your eyes when meditating? What about if not? One of the reasons why we close our eyes when we meditate is so that other people who've got an itchy nose can pick it while you're not looking. They can scratch parts of their body they wouldn't dare scratch when people have got their eyes open. So it's compassion for other people to not look what they're up to. Sometimes I'd be frightened to open my eyes during meditation. So one of the reasons, the real reason why we close our eyes when we're meditating is because we're not being disturbed by other people. So it's one way we can settle the disturbance of the senses. When you open your eyes, there's always someone doing something or moving. When you close your eyes, it's like being in a cave. Blackness, darkness, nothing moving. So that's why we close our eyes. And it is much better to close your eyes when you're meditating than to keep them open.
The next question.
Here we go. Two questions here. Ajahn Brahm, as an inspiration, please explain anatta and citta arising and passing away phenomena. Thank you for your very hard work to teach us. Anatta, I've already mentioned that. There's no one in there. Why? There is nothing. You go deep inside, and things disappear. You vanish. David Copperfield couldn't do that. Apparently he vanished a jumbo jet or something, but he never vanished himself. The Buddha is a great magician. Poof, and you're gone. It's a wonderful thing to disappear, because being is a lot of problems. So anatta means there's no substantial self inside of you. There's no core. There's whether all those five khandhas which the Buddha divided the body and mind into, like the body, feeling, perception, thinking and will, and consciousness. It's not me, not mine, not a self. Because it's not you, it's not yours, it's none of your business. That's one of my mantras, which I like people to say during the meditation. Whatever's happening, you're going crazy, none of my business. You're seeing nimittas, none of my business. You're having just bliss and you're seeing the Buddha, none of my business. This is just five khandhas, none of my business. It's called detachment. Doesn't belong to you at all. Wow, that gives you incredible freedom. That's actually when I remember reading the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. It said, you know, if consciousness was yours, if mind belonged to you, you'd be able to control your consciousness. Say, consciousness, be like this, be like that. Can you control your consciousness? Can you control your will? Can you control your perception or your feelings? So you're old enough now, you can't control it. You think you can, and that's your delusion. You think that these things are in your power to control. And the Buddha said so clearly in the second sermon, Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, this was the first teaching which made the first enlightened being, fully enlightened arahats. He said, all this stuff, your body, your mind, doesn't belong to you. It's part of nature. You know, some people think they can control their body. Come on, get real. How many of you want to get cancer? None of you do, but many of you will. How many of you want to get sick and tired and get old? None of you do, but most of you will. How many of you will die, all of you? Do you want to die? Not really. You cannot control your body. You should know that by now. If you can't control it, what right have you to say it's yours and it belongs to you? Your body belongs to nature. It follows the laws of nature. It doesn't follow your command. There comes a time in life when you say, I want to put my right foot forward, and it doesn't go in the right, correct place. When you lose total control, you can't even control your bowels or your urine. You're born with nappies, and many of you will end up with nappies. It's true. You can't control it. Nor can you control your mind. You try, and you won't be able to do it. And if you look at the second teaching of the Buddha, he said that specifically, clearly, that you can't control the mind or the will or the perception or the feelings or the body. Which proves it's nothing to do with you. So if you realize, if you truly realize you can't control these things, what do you do? Let go. None of my business. I can't control the Buddhist Society of Victoria. I'm a spiritual advisor. I just give advice, but I'm not the spiritual dictator. You do whatever you want. I give you advice, follow it, don't follow it. I can't make you. Have you ever tried to control your husband? Yeah, you have. Foolish. No way you can do that. You can't even control yourself. How can you control somebody else? So there comes a time you let go. And now when you realize you can't control the mind, now you know how to meditate. Just watch and let go. Stop trying to control. You know you can't do it. Not my business. And then you really get still. When you stop trying, because you know it's impossible to do anything, you just make things worse. Then you've understood the teaching of anatta in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. You've let go. Then you get incredibly still and also enlightened at the same time. You've tested the theory and it works. Nothing to do with me. You've got no attachment left to anything. What you attach to, you tend to control. When you give up control, you completely detach. Isn't that a wonderful thing to do? It makes life so easy. Peace at last. I can't meditate. This meditation happens when I stop trying. There we go. And citta. Citta is just the mind. And even the mind you can't control doesn't belong to you. So the mind just, what my way of wants to do can do. So even the mind just disappears and vanishes. Bye-bye, mind. So you just completely disappear. Nothing left. No attachments. No attachments to a citta, to a mind, to anything. Whenever there's something left there, it means you're attached to it. So just let completely go. Now you're free. Empty, gone. Isn't that wonderful? Peace at last. After all these years in samsara. Next question. Is a citta manifest as consciousness at one time and wisdom mindfulness at another time? So citta is not changing. Is citta conditioned or unconditioned? Citta is conditioned. The Buddha mentioned that clearly. If you want to look that up, look at the very first sutta in the first collection, Brahmajala Sutta, where the Buddha said that thinking the citta is permanent, unchanging, is wrong view number 8 of the 63 wrong views. Check it out. The Buddha said that. Anyone who thinks the citta is unchanging, permanent, that's wrong view number 8. Brahmajala Sutta. Check it out. Even this mind just disappears. It doesn't belong to you. It's just citta, that sort. It's just consciousness. And consciousness comes about by causes. You have to have the mechanism of that consciousness, like mind consciousness. You have to have an object. The coming of the two together is called contact. And then you have the conscious experience. If you have to have consciousness, the Buddha is saying, you have to be conscious of something. You can't just have consciousness without being conscious of something. That's just a myth of delusion. If you have consciousness, it's consciousness of something. So you ask, you know, what's consciousness conscious of? It just keeps on changing. It's impermanent. It's caused, fashioned. Impermanent, subject to change, and therefore suffering. That's why even the Buddha said, even this mind will get destroyed, will vanish and go. That's in Talaputta, his verses in the Theragata. Even this mind will get destroyed at last.
You said that consciousness is changing and
yeah.
It's not impermanent.
It is permanent, yeah.
The stream of consciousness that you carry to the next life.
Stream of consciousness is like the river Yarra. So, amazing, the river Yarra looks exactly the same this year as it did the last time I came here. However, you know that that's just a superficial looking at it. It's a stream. Every molecule of water which you see this year is not what was there last year. So what we take as a stream of consciousness, if you look from too far away, not superficially, it looks like it's a continuum. But if you look closely, its content is completely different. Even the channel changes over the decades. The channel is like the karma. The karma actually guides the stream of consciousness in one direction. But little by little you can change the inclinations of your stream of consciousness from life to life. Some people are inclined to be really good people. Some people are inclined to anger or selfishness. These are like the banks of the river of your stream of consciousness. But you know that from your geology, history, from your science, the rivers actually do change their courses over time. people can change their characters. It shows a stream of consciousness which is guided by these banks of the river. You know, being good people or bad people, you can change that inclination, which is why we can train ourselves. But the stream of consciousness is just many conscious moments linked together, like many little molecules of water, all flowing. That's like the stream of consciousness. It's not a thing, it's a process. That makes sense?
The process is permanent, and the molecule, the piece of consciousness is impermanent, but that stream is permanent.
The stream is more permanent, but even rivers dry up eventually. Look at the Murray River. It's drying up. That used to be a huge river. Now, after years, sometimes rivers dry up. Sometimes streams of consciousness, when they become enlightened, dry up. And you don't flow into any more rebirth. So a stream of consciousness, if a stream of consciousness was permanent, there'd be no hope. You keep on getting reborn forever and ever and ever, round and round and round and round and round. And because the stream of consciousness is not permanent, because it can stop, therefore there's freedom. Freedom from the round of rebirth. Only when you're bored and had enough with all this rebirth business, when you've had enough with nappies, had enough with going to school again, and don't think you're finished with school. You get reborn again, you have to start all from scratch, grade one, all over again. You'd have a dummy stuck in your mouth.
Ajahn, can I tie that back to what you said about anatta?
Yep.
That you're saying, if I'm correctly understanding, it's a matter of not joining those moments, no?
No, it's not joining those moments, it's those moments. What drives them forward is taken away. The force which drives them, that's craving. Yeah, the anatta is seeing that they are impermanent, they're not substantial.
Yeah.
They're cause. And because they're caused, when a cause is taken away, they stop. The best description is a flame. A flame is caused on the candle by three things. The wax, the wick, and the heat. If any one of those three causes is taken away, the wax is all used up, the wick is exhausted, or a wind blows the heat away, the flame goes out. So a flame is not permanent. The flame is impermanent. It's got these three causes. And the same, even consciousness has causes. When those causes are removed, consciousness goes out. And the main cause is delusion and craving. They keep the cause, they're the main causes which keep the mind continuing on and on and on and on. When those two causes are removed, consciousness stops. That's what happens at the end of the life of the arahant. And you know what, as I said the other day, the word for the flame being extinguished is nibbana. In the time of the Buddha, every villager would understand the meaning of that word. It was a word in common usage. It means when flames go out, when fires get extinguished. So people in that time, because that was their local language, their common language, when Buddha started talking about Nibbana, they know exactly what it meant. Yeah, at the back. Yep.
The feeling is not yours.
Correct.
Perception is not yours.
Yeah.
Mental formation, consciousness, all not yours.
Yeah.
Then who's you that you are referring to?
All you are you referring to is just a designation, a name, like sometimes you call that a camera, sometimes you call this a piece of paper. But this is a skillful means for being able to communicate. You never think this is really a piece of paper. It's made up of fibers. It's made up of dye. That's all it truly is. So when you say who you are, you look deeper, you use that to describe yourself. I have to say what my name is on the passport or on the airline ticket. Otherwise, they never let me on the aircraft to get it to Perth. If they said, who are you? And I say, nobody. I'm a non-self manager. Then they would never let me on Qantas at all. I've even got a frequent flyer card. I've even got a number. But when we look deeper, we never assume that that has more meaning than it deserves.
But my question was really, when you let everything go, when you refer to you, there should be something left as you.
No, it's just... if I really was being accurate, say the particular set of five candles which is in front of you now is now speaking. But I mean, that is really stupid speech. So in order to communicate, we say Ajahn Brahm or Ajahn Brahma Wang So or whatever you wish to call a person, or you say me or I. But that is just, even the Buddha said that this is just the language we have to use to communicate, but you don't misunderstand it. Even the Buddha would say, you know, the Tathagata, me. But he would never understand or assume that there was a soul, a being, a personality, something which was lasting, permanent, which would transcend death. Now you may notice that you try and capture that meaning through just thinking and through reason. It can't get that far. All of your reason and your arguments, reason and arguments are very useful for sweeping away illogical statements. However, to get to truth, you have to do more than reason, which is why the Buddha said you can't hammer this out with reason. It's much deeper than that. You have to have experience. Experience of things which really shock you, because these are things which you are beyond your normal experience, which are real, you see, you feel, you know. These are the experiences of deep meditation, which change the way you look at life. As an example of what I mean, that when I started learning science, I learned things such as, you know, there's certain stars, I think Alpha Centauri, which is about 6 light-years away or something like that, I can't remember exactly, but say it's 6 light-years away. And you can't travel faster than the speed of light. So you can't get to Alpha Centauri earlier than 6 years. But then later on in science, I learned you can get to Alpha Centauri in 10 minutes if you want. That's Einstein's easy special theory of relativity. You want to go 6 light-years away, you can get there in 5 minutes if you've got a fast enough engine and you don't get squashed with the acceleration forces. I said, how can that happen? That's illogical. At first it seems illogical, but the explanation is the faster you go, the distance gets contracted. It's called Lorentz contraction. Fitzgerald contraction, it's Lorentz dilation of time. For you, it takes 10 minutes to get to Alpha Centauri, the traveller. But as we watch that spacecraft go, it takes at least 6 years from people watching on Earth. It takes you 10 minutes to get back, another 6 years here on Earth. That paradox of the twins, one goes to Alpha Centauri, the other one stays on Earth. When it comes back, one is 12 years older than the other. Now that's basic science. It doesn't make any sense if you haven't done the equations and understand Einstein's special theory. It seems illogical, but it is true. This is one example. One of the things I learned from science was what appears to be reasonable. You're just not seeing deeply enough. You get more data, more understanding, and you find what at first seemed irrational actually is true. And that's just one example. Two twins, one goes off to Alpha Centauri and back, and they come back, and the 12 years has gone on Earth, but 20 minutes has gone for the twin who went in the spacecraft. And that has actually been proved. An experiment's been done, that is actually fact. And it's weirder stuff when you get into quantum science. But what that shows you, you need data. And the data we use in Buddhism is the deep meditations called the jhanas. There you get evidence of things disappearing which just shouldn't disappear. The simile which I gave earlier, which is the most powerful, tadpole, how can a tadpole know what water is? It's born in water, lived all its life in water, can theorize in water, can think it knows about water, can go to Tadpole University and do a degree in water, but it won't know what water is. Tadpole one day grows into a frog. And when it jumps outside the water, only then could it really know what water is, when it's disappeared. Your mind, which I've described earlier on, two parts of the mind, the doer and the knower. It's an accurate way of splitting up the mind. When you get into second jhana, the doer, the will, has completely vanished. Not there anymore. The potential to do anything has gone. You have got out of the lake of will. And you think you can know what will is and choice is and doing is when it's always been there for you, been immersed in it since you were born. Since the earliest you can remember, even if you remember past lives, the will is still there for you. This is the only human experience which is apart from will, second jhana and beyond. When you get into that state, you come out afterwards, it's as plain on the nose in your face what will is, and it's not you. Nothing to do with you. Not a person, not a self. You've seen it completely vanish. Now that's the sort of evidence which shows you anatta. That's only half of the self, by the way, or half of what you take to be you. The other half goes as you go deeper in the jhanas. As a mind, the jitta fragments and vanishes. That is not what you expect. That's what happens. Da da da. Yes.
Is it correct to say that pronouns such as you, me, him are conventional labels used to communicate?
That's right. That's all they are. Convention, because we agreed to use them for the purposes of dialogue. That's right, yeah. That's right, we change personalities. Sometimes, like now, I'm Ajahn Brahm, the teacher. Sometimes when I go to the monastery, I'm Ajahn Brahm, the bricklayer. Sometimes... It's great being a monk, because you take on all sorts of incredibly different roles. You know, that in that fourth global conference, which we were talking about the other day, because the fifth conference coming in... sixth, in Auckland in December. When we did our global conference, for a bit of entertainment, I did an interview with John Howard. With the puppet John Howard. One of the guys here from the BSV was a puppeteer. I haven't seen him. I'm not sure where he's gone to. And he made a puppet of John Howard. And as a bit of entertainment, you know, after a euthanasia with Dr. Philip Nitschke, which is a pretty heavy subject to discuss, I went up on stage and had an interview with a puppet who looked like John Howard. So then I was the entertainer, the comic. It's amazing the different roles you can have as a monk. Which one is a real Ajahn Brahm? I don't know. None of them are. So it is, you say, conventional realities, don't take it seriously. But all of that is philosophy. And that doesn't really cut the ice as far as it comes to meditation or to wisdom. You've got to have powerful experiences which overturn the way you look at things. More data. The unexpected data. Okay, one last question before we do some meditation, before we finish off. What is the role of so-called rites and rituals in Buddhism? Or what does it mean when it is said that one lets go of these? One lets go of the idea that rites and rituals are so essential, that you always have to do a Buddha puja, or you have to do chanting all night, or you have to do it this way and that way. Even keeping the five precepts, I thought, to save time, because you always go through these five precepts again and again. You can actually chant after me, I determine to keep the five precepts in English, and that's done with. Why not? Why do you always have to go in Pali, you know, Namo Tassa, and Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, and Paranati Pata Weramani? Why can't you just say, I undertake to keep the five precepts? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Some of the rites and rituals go too far. And I don't mind saying that one of the things which I do think goes far too far, which actually was against the Buddha's actually words, when he said when you're teaching the Dhamma or even reciting suttas, they should be in a normal voice at normal speed. And was a couple of years ago here, we were doing all-night paritta chanting, and I just couldn't believe what I had heard. When the monks were going namo, and it took about 5 minutes to do one namo, na. Now that never happened in the time of the Buddha. That's a Sri Lankan ritual. And I ask you, is it really necessary? Does it really have to be done that way? Wouldn't that time be better spent meditating or listening to a Dhamma teaching? Now I'm challenging. Thais are even worse. They have their rituals of having these medallions. These Buddha, they have so many medallions, it gives them neck aches sometimes, all this stuff hanging around their neck. And just to show you how, this is not just a joke, this is dangerous. There was a general, this was in the Australian papers, a general who brought, this was years ago, who bought a medallion for $500,000. You can go to Bangkok and these medallions are really expensive, big time money. $500,000 US for a little medallion. Why did he buy this? Because this was said to protect him from bullets. Fair enough, being in the Thai military, you know, there's lots of bullets go around in coups and goodness knows what else. So, one evening he was in the officer's mess after dinner, having had a few shots of Mekong whiskey, which is not good for you anyway. This is what happened. He was boasting about this medallion. $500,000 I spent for this. It protects me against bullets. Yeah. He said, I'll prove it to you. And he handed his revolver to a major, and he ordered, being a general, told the major to shoot him. The medallion would stop the bullet. So the officer followed orders and shot the general, and the general was stone dead. So much for 500, he was dead, he couldn't claim the money back. No insurance. And that's a stupid thing which people do. And that's rites and rituals which people do. So sometimes that it's very good if Buddhists would be more skeptical and be more challenging. And the other thing, which is a big thing in many places, you've got these deva lights. It's about time you actually saw through those things. They are dust particles. I was a theoretical physicist. That's a classic diffraction pattern. If you don't believe me, just get on the internet, ORBS, orbs. When I did that years ago, just for fun, you see that those deva lights appeared in pubs in England. No deva would go into a pub. But in England, because all these pubs were old, the English idiots thought they were ghosts. And now they had photographic evidence of ghosts. And the United States, they don't believe so much in ghosts. When they have their diffraction patterns on their photographs, they said, no, it's not ghosts or devil, this is aliens. This is the first sign we've got photographic evidence of ET. Now, you may think that it's just people with low intelligence think that those lights could be ET or ghosts. But how come some people think they're devas? Do the research, ask the questions, don't just believe, don't be gullible. If you are gullible, you're no better than these born-again Christians who believe that, was it 20 million species of animal could go on an ark by Noah. Which, you know, you look at Melbourne Zoo and how you can get Melbourne Zoo on any existing boat, even though, you know, today no boats are big enough. And how you keep those animals apart, not eating each other. Gee. So, don't be gullible. Question. Question your monks, no matter who they are, and your nuns. Rites and rituals are overcome when we use our common sense and we question, and we ask those tough questions, and we don't stop until we get an honest answer. Do the research. Otherwise, the people will just, Buddhism will just die. And all the really brilliant, good teachings will go smothered by rites and rituals. So, do the right thing. Okay, so there's my polemic against rites and rituals. Now, instead of doing rituals, we can do some last meditation. It's only got half an hour left, but that's enough time. So, those of you who are interested in not just listening, but experiencing the Dhamma, let's do a half an hour of real deep meditation. Let go to the max. So if you want to get up and stretch your legs, fine. If you don't, fine. Last push to Nibbana. So when you're ready, sit down, close your eyes, and shut up. So sitting down here, check on your body, make sure that you're ready for takeoff. Legs in the right place, comfortable. The bottom not too tightly pressed against the chair. Back nice, shoulders nice, hands nice. And put a little smile on your face. It makes it easier as you're letting go. This body does not belong to you. It's like a car which you've rented. You put it in the car park, you close the doors, put on the alarm, and you don't need to worry about it for the next, this time, half an hour. So you've got your body well set up, it's safe. Walk away from it. Time, present, future, past, it's just all a concept. Let go of all perception of time. See, just now. Future. The only place the future is made is now. This is the only time you have to create good karma for your future. If you really care about the future, you will care about the now. Because this is where the future is made. The past, just a dream. Abandon it. Doesn't belong to you. It's finished. It's past its expiry date. All you have is this moment called now. And all this thinking business, it just misses the point every time. As Lao Tzu said, when you are say, what a beautiful sunset. You're not watching the sunset anymore, you're only watching the words. So don't watch the words. Watch the silence which is there before the words begin. And in that silence, in this moment, stop all controlling. Whatever you're aware of, and what is aware, doesn't belong to you. Let both of those things go. There is nothing, just this play of consciousness, this stream, which has nothing to do with you or yourself. So stop interfering. You can't control it anyway, so don't try. close to the end now. If you haven't got enlightened yet, coming back again next year. I'm now going to ring the gong 3 times. At the end of the 3rd sound from the gong, you can come out for your meditation. So hopefully that you've enjoyed the 2 days of meditation and talk, a few jokes, but also you gain some more understanding and wisdom of what meditation is all about and how to lead the mind effortlessly into deep stages of peace. And those very deep, peaceful, still meditations are where you really understand just what anatta is, suffering is, everything is, so you can get stuff which will make you enlightened. Peace, joy, freedom, and the end of samsara. If you haven't done that yet, don't worry, the seeds have been planted. Little by little, just the mind opens up, and you feel that this is the truth, the right way, because it leads to such peace, such strength, such inner freedom. So I wish you all success in your meditation. I now do the sharing of merits so we can finish off. You can go out and get your dinner and maybe see you this evening at Monash.
Idam men yatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.